Hi, I'm Alex Beam. I'm a columnist for the Living Arts section of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to my Hate Mail podcast, which producer Ann Silvio and I get to about every 6 weeks or so. This is our first podcast of 2008. We're very enthusiastic. We have two terrific readers, both of whom work with me in the Living Arts section of the Boston Globe, reading all the letters from women whom happily I've managed to outrage in equal numbers as men. For this particular podcast is Cheryl Holland, who works as an administrator in the section, and reading the letters from men is Wesley Morris, whom I hope many of you read, along with his colleague Ty Burr. He and Ty are our movie reviewers, and you can also see them. There's quite a bit of video featuring Ty and Wesley on the Boston.com website. In any case, I think we have some good letters full of bile, invective, generally vindictive, all aimed against me to start off the new year. I can't guarantee that the hate mail podcasts are going to be quite as frequent as they have been in the past because I'm going on leave starting in early February for about 6 weeks to write a book, which doubtless I'll return and try to sell. You'll be hearing so much about my book, you'll be sick to death of it. Thank you, and here we go. So on December 12th, I wrote a kind of yearly roundup column, the way lazy columnists always do towards the end of the year, except instead of sort of the year in politics or the year in pictures, I decided to write the year in fat, a roundup of the most absurd diet trends and stories that have been emailed to me or that I had seen in the press. One of my very favorites was Posh Spice put her husband David Beckham on a specific diet so that they could have a baby girl. And then hilariously, this same ridiculous witch doctor type voodoo showed up at the Harvard School of Public Health, where Dr. Walter Willett, who enjoys a certain prestige in the field of nutrition, devoted a whole book to the fertility diet. In my view, a totally bogus idea. In any case, I went out of my way to make fun of Dr. Siegel's cookie diet, which again seemed like straight out of the pages of Cosmopolitan, the idea that you could eat chocolate chip cookies day in and day out and somehow get thinner. And in my email inbox the next day was this letter from Dr. Siegel's son, Matthew, the chief executive officer of Dr. Siegel's cookies.
Hi, Alex. I noticed this morning that you lumped Dr. Siegel's cookie diet in with misinformation, swamp remedies, idiocy, and plain outright lies about diet and weight. Had you done any research or fact-checking, did you even bother to Google Sanford Siegel? You would have discovered that Dr. Sanford Siegel is not a quack, but a prominent practicing physician whose South Florida medical practice has treated more than 500,000 overweight patients using his proprietary methods and hunger-controlling foods. Despite its catchy name, which apparently you were unable to get past, Dr. Siegel's cookie diet is a proven system that safely produces rapid weight loss without hunger and is used and prescribed by doctors throughout North America.
Matthew, thank you for setting the record straight, and I have only a brief two-word reply. Quack, quack. A few days later, I wrote a column about Clinton fatigue, which was an idea I actually stole from a colleague because he remembered how Clinton fatigue became a buzzword among the commentariat sort of in the last year and a half of Bill Clinton's presidency, which would be tending towards 1998, 1999. Clinton was up for impeachment, et cetera, and people just started writing, gosh, we're really sick of this guy, in a way that I think reasonable people are pretty much sick of the Bush administration now. But I made the point, I sort of married this notion of 10-year-old Clinton fatigue with current Clinton fatigue, because there was a period in Iowa and New Hampshire when Hillary Clinton, for whatever reason, was practically campaigning in tandem with Bill constantly. And I didn't think it was doing her any favors. In fact, at the end of this column, I even suggested that Bill Clinton was undermining her candidacy, whether consciously or unconsciously. Curiously, at the top of that column, I quoted a now-deceased extreme right-wing columnist named Linda Bowles, and that really got the goat of reader Phil Nathan.
Linda Bowles, eh? Why not Dan Burton? Jesus Christ, fella, your bile is filling the house gutters. Nothing like perpetuating the Clinton malice, i.e. Arkansas Project, to deflect from the disastrous, incompetent follies of co-presidents Bush, Cheney, et al. Incorporated. What a H-O-O-T.
Phil, what a G-R-E-A-T, L-E-T-T-E-R. Thank you for writing. And now here's another point of view from Jean Yoakum of Granby, Massachusetts.
Loved today's column, except for your support of President Clinton's decision not to intervene in Rwanda. Try reading Shake Hands with the Devil by Romeo Dallaire and see if you still feel that way. I bought it a long time ago, but never got around to reading it until last month. An eye-opening read, to say the least. There is plenty of blame to go around for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people, but the actions of the U.S. at the U.N. are unforgivable. At a time that called for leadership, we provided none. Zero. Zip. It would have cost so little to save so many.
Thank you, Jean. That was a reference low down in the column to Bill Clinton's continual apology for failing to intervene during the hecatomb in Rwanda in 1997. I argued in the column that he didn't have to apologize for that, but I'm certainly familiar with the Romeo Dallaire book, and I'm certainly aware of the fact that literally millions of people disagree with me, and they may well be right. Here's a longer letter that goes right up to the whole sex thing involving the Clintons, and the writer is Jane Stein of Shoreham, Vermont.
Dear Mr. Bean, peccadilloes? Okay, sure. More than, say, George W. Bush? I don't know about that. Lying. Really? Well, there was. I did not have sexual relations with that woman. There was a lot of discussion about that. Some people thought it was a lie. Other people pointed out that many, many men, perhaps the majority, generally don't consider oral favors as sexual relations or even having sex. But even granting that one, what were the other lies? And gee whiz, Mr. Bean, you can complain about Bill Clinton lying after 7 years of bald-faced lies from the current occupant of the White House and his various minions and appointees about things like wars and global warming and political persecutions and torture and spying wholesale on U.S. citizens? I must say, that takes a little crust and a hell of a lot of tunnel vision. And finally, just who is it exactly that has or ever had Clinton fatigue? Ever look at the polls now and then? You guys in the chattering classes sure had Clinton fatigue and tried your darndest to convince the rest of us. But if you're going to be honest, you have to admit that it didn't work. The man was popular when he was impeached, popular when he left office, and popular now. You know what I've got? I've got pundit fatigue.
January 9th, I devoted an entire column to a book by a woman named Suzette Standring, who lives in Milton, and her book was called, quote, The Art of Column Writing, unquote. Anyway, it was a very harsh piece. A lot of people are worried about the future of my soul because Suzette is a wonderful person. I happen to know her, although I did warn her, as I mentioned in the column, to her face. I said, if you send me your book, I promise I'm going to make fun of it. And I did. And my real problem was I had too much fun making fun of her book. But in any case, at the very end of her book, she asks actually one of many silly rhetorical questions that pepper throughout the book. She asks, can a columnist have friends? And I answered in the column, well, at least my dog loves me. But one of Suzanne's friends named Jean Kelly even questioned me on that point.
Dear Mr. Beam, I'm not so sure your dog would still love you if he read your January 9th, 2008 column. Your review of syndicated columnist Suzette Standring's book was one thing. Your underlying commentary on her as a person was quite another. Perhaps you thought it was funny to bash her, along with her book, all in the name of good fun. Maybe you haven't had to promote yourself for such a long time that you've forgotten that not everyone's name follows with a reference to the Boston Globe. Freelance writers must do their own public relations and do not have the press you obviously take for granted. It is funny that the most important advice you offered college students studying journalism was to steal. In the spirit of my all-time favorite columnist, the late and much-missed Donald Murray, I think your dog would be ashamed of you.
You know, my dog actually said there weren't too many problems with that column, Jean. She is a faithful reader. Really one of my most devoted readers and a close personal friend. Thank you for mentioning Don Murray, whose work I came to appreciate perhaps too late. Here's a much more pithy comment aimed to hit me right where it hurts. The writer is Ruth Boltopoulos.
Well, Alex, if your dog loves you so much, why did she piss in your oatmeal yesterday?
So in that same incredibly nasty and mean-spirited column of Wednesday, January 9th, I also ran a short item about a book that's going to be coming out in a few weeks. It's a biography of Jerry Williams, whom probably many people still remember. He was, in a sense, kind of the number one radio talk show act here in Boston, also in Chicago, for many, many years. I thought he was getting pretty long in the tooth when I arrived in Boston. I got here in 84, and then he had this fantastic kind of, at least successful show called The Governors, where he and Barbara Anderson, who was an anti-tax advocate, and Howie Carr, actually just sort of made a living out of trashing Michael Dukakis, who later went on to run for the presidency without much success, as we know. In any case, in this particular column, I just complained about Jerry Williams and said that he had really begun his embarrassing eclipse in the mid-1980s. And two readers, the first one, Paul Yovino, felt pretty strongly that I had my facts wrong on this one.
Alex, I have to take issue with you on a part of your free plug review of Steve Ellman and Alan Toles' book on Jerry Williams. I haven't read the book at this time, but I was interviewed for it as Jerry's first executive producer when he came back to Boston in 1981 at WRKO. During the 2 years that I produced the program, he was not in the, quote, embarrassing eclipse, unquote, of his remarkable broadcasting career. Jerry was always number one in the Arbitron ratings in all demographics. I am not sure that I had any exclusive talent other than to follow Jerry's precept that his program always be interesting, entertaining, and, to quote Jerry, never boring. Talk radio today is not the talk radio of the 1980s, and that is not for the better. Talk radio today is not only mean-spirited, but always predictable, and therefore, in my opinion, always, quote, boring, unquote. Carr, Severin, Graham, and their ilk are always, quote, embarrassing, unquote, and more to my point, always boring and predictable.
Yeah, that's a good letter, Paul, and I got into sort of a peeing match with this guy on the internet that there's no point in going over. But, I mean, ratings are ratings, and Williams ruled the roost ratings-wise. The point I made to him in our exchange was that, you know, my column's my judgment, and I thought Jerry Williams was basically pretty flat. But here comes someone who not only thinks the opposite, but can back it up because she was on the air with him for several years, Barbara Anderson.
Hi, Alex. Jerry Williams had begun his embarrassing eclipse by the time you showed up here in the mid-80s. I think not. Either you have forgotten when you came in, or you've forgotten The Governors, 88 to 92, which I suspect was the hottest, most listened to talk radio in history, though I didn't realize it at the time when I was in the middle of it. Was in New Hampshire this weekend, and people came up to me to say they listened to Jerry, Howie, and me every Tuesday, and I still hear this all the time. Later, of course, Jerry did become obsessed with the Big Dig and a few other issues. Did them all the time. He was right about them, too, we learnt later. Optimistic activist, I found it had, toward the end, to deal with his constant there's no hope. But now I wonder.
Well, thanks for being in touch, Barbara. There's one fascinating detail that she includes that also is featured in this book, of course, which is that Howie Carr was first on talk radio, sort of as a sidekick to Jerry Williams, and he's since gone on to make a tremendous amount of money in that line of work. So getting into the Wayback Machine, on May 9th, I wrote a column that got a lot of attention. The headline was President Obama, Not This Time. And as I truthfully pointed out, it was exactly the same column I'd written every 4 years, previously about Bill Bradley, previously about Howard Dean, pointing out that there's always a terrific kind of hope-slash-intelligentsia candidate for president, generally in the Democratic primary, who's not going to win. And I mean, it's an opinion piece. It's not a fact. I mean, it's not like I knew on May 9th, not like I know sitting here right now, whether Barack Obama is going to get the nomination and become president. But in any case, I made a strong case from my point of view that he wouldn't. What's really strange is that I keep getting email about this column as if it was written yesterday. I guess it's in some weird kind of Google cycle. And specifically, I got a fair amount of email about it after Obama triumphed in the Iowa caucuses. Everybody actually just sent me email asking me to retract what I had written, but I'm not in the mood. In any case, here are three letters I got in January about a piece I wrote in early May.
Hey, Alex. How do you feel about Obama now? Have you underestimated the voters? Jeanette DeLapp.
Ready to recant yet? It seems Barack may have a real chance. Daniel Loeb.
Just read your article online after searching for Obama updates. It was written in May. Prior to Tuesday, I agreed with what you wrote, wondering if you had any change of heart. Colette McLaughlin.
A friend of mine has a great comeback. When people question his newspaper columns, he quotes Pontius Pilate from the Bible, who famously said, "Quod dixi dixi," which was when they asked him to recant. And, of course, we all wish perhaps that he had. When he was asked to recant his judgment on Jesus Christ, he said, "What I have said, I have said." So I always send my readers a little brief note. Quod scripsi, scripsi, what I have written, I have written. Well, on January 14th, I wrote a column with the headline, "The Truth May Already Be Out There." Obviously, I was stealing the catchphrase from what was really one of my all-time favorite TV shows that my sons and I used to watch religiously on Sunday night, if memory serves, The X-Files, where they were always sort of delving into some purported conspiracy theories and suggesting that, quote, the truth may be out there. This column was actually sort of pegged to a public television documentary on the John F. Kennedy assassination. And what interested me about the documentary, which I, of course, remember, as every man or woman listening to this who was alive in 1963 remembers, was that, frankly, even the greatest conspiracy theorists who had examined the Kennedy killing and the subsequent Warren report had actually kind of backed off a lot of their thoughts and were kind of thinking, shrugging their shoulders, saying there's a lot of evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was a strange, intense sort of combination of left and right extremism and probably assassinated John Kennedy. And then I went on to sort of attack 9/11 conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theorists generally. And so here's a letter we got from Carl Weiss in Sedona.
Sir, maybe you have and maybe you have not heard Secretary of Transportation Norman Natta's testimony to the 9/11 Commission, given May 23, 2003, available on YouTube via a simple Google search. I'd like to know what your take is on that. Hope you have the time. If not, then I question all you have written as blowing smoke without having done the necessary research. Carl Weiss, Sedona, his phone number, and happy to hold a civil conversation.
Okay, Carl, I actually went to YouTube. I actually found Norman Mineta's testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And, you know, I just don't get it. I did almost everything that every reader asked me to do via email. You know, read this document, look at this incredible, you know, quote-unquote proof that there was no plane that crashed into the Pentagon. Look at the quote-unquote proof that so-called Building 7 next to the World Trade Center was dynamited. I mean, you know, God knows who dynamited it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, fine. You know, go out, go to YouTube, find the Mineta testimony. It's evocative of absolutely nothing. Here's another letter again from Phil Nathan.
As expected, you excluded Bush Cheney Inc. et al., extended family benefactors, the one true enemy of our constitutional republic, and murderers for hire, House of Saud and Saudi Arabia.
Yes, Phil, I did exclude them because, astonishingly, I guess I hold the minority view that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney did not dynamite the World Trade Center for their own political ends. Lastly, we have a note from a reader who asked to remain anonymous.
Remember, Alex, these agents likely had a reason to do it. And why would so much evidence still be withheld? I know nothing about JFK, but I do know criminal investigation is needed for 9/11. All the best. Anonymous, please.
Thank you all so much. Keep the cards and letters coming. Your wonderful negative reactions make our wonderful, positive, love-filled hate mail podcast.